welcome to Michigan HockeyCast 3.4, where we find out that Alex is also older than Craig Ross. So I walk into our suite at Yoast, and the guy who sits behind me, because there's one guy who sits behind me, and then he starts talking, and as soon as he does, an usher walks in and kind of interrupts him and says, "Oh good, I'm glad you're here tonight, because now we can watch football." And I was like, I kind of started laughing. I was like, "What?" And they're like, "Oh, we can't really work the remotes, but you know how to run all these TVs, because there's TVs in there." So I like started putting them on, and we were figuring out which games, like which ones are we going to watch, all this stuff. And I just kind of kept laughing because I was like, first of all, it's a really cool setup. But then also, it's like, you know, just this is sort of what I'm known for. Like there's things in life that I've always sort of like, you know, you want to be known as like the dependable one or the guy who like makes good decisions or, you know, he's a good friend or something. And it, that sort of thing. But like known as the guy who knows how to get football on the TV, I don't know. I kind of take a little bit of like shallow pride in that.
I can respect that.
Do you have something you can relate to in that? I'm sure, like, you're a nice guy. So like, I'm not talking about that. I just mean like some off the wall or something that people associate with you.
Okay, I got an even better one for you than what we discussed earlier.
Okay.
On like class trips and such, and even now going on trips for, you know, covering sports and things.
Sure.
I always buy newspapers before I go on the flight.
You buy a newspaper?
Yes.
Do like, they still print them?
Yeah. You go to like,
really?
You know, like the store right outside your gate, you know, that's got the snacks and waters and...
Fascinating. And you read the newspaper?
Yeah. So I always try to get either New York Times or Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
So that's a reading paper that has actual information. And then the USA Today, which has always just kind of got, you know, puff articles, but they've got the best puzzles page out there.
Ah.
And actually, funny story, I was doing that before I came here. I went grocery shopping today, and every week when I go to Myers, I always make sure to buy a USA Today.
For the puzzles?
Yeah.
Is there not, like, an app for puzzles?
Okay. I live in 1955, so...
So you can punt, and it's okay. So the other thing that happened this weekend is I was walking back from the bathroom, and I just kind of glanced over, and I walked by Red Berenson's suite, and he's there, sitting in a suit by himself, because there's not really as many people in there.
It was empty this week.
It was pretty empty. And he's just eating popped maize. Like, just out. And this is, like, before the game. And I just started laughing. And I don't even really know why I started laughing. I guess, first of all, I was kind of shocked to see food, although I did kind of bring my own dinner. But, like, if you're Red Berenson, is that the food of your food of choice? Or did you think he just went downstairs and just bought popped maize?
Okay, two thoughts. Number one... Is your complaint with popped maize or popcorn in specific?
Well, have you ever seen that stuff?
I've had it before, yes.
And?
I don't think it's very good.
That's
but
more my...
I've always thought it was too salty. That was my thought. Like, they sell those, like, giant waters at the sporting events that are, like, $8. But, like, you need that whole thing to get all that salt down. Like, it's...
That's true.
It's rough.
But have you been to Chrysler where they have, like, extra strength, large garbage bags of this popcorn? Like, it feels like it was all popped in September and then is equally dispersed throughout the year.
It probably was.
So,
but second thought, anyone got food is kind of shocking to me. Like, I get Red, you know, is getting some food, but no food for us.
Yeah. Well,
my broadcast partner on Saturday though said that I didn't win 600 or some games for Michigan like Red did, so.
Well, that is true. But if we're going by that, I feel like, come on, get him something better than popped maize.
Maybe he likes popped maize.
Maybe he does.
We'll have to bring him on.
So we've been rambling now for a while, and you probably still don't know who we are because we're not even sure of who we are. But I think that I'm David Nasternak, and are you?
I don't know who I am because I'm questioning my life decisions after watching those games this weekend. So
oh, they weren't.
I was at football on Saturday afternoon, and then I went and saw hockey on Saturday night.
That's a day.
It's a day.
And then Michigan basketball almost loses to Oakland.
But I wasn't there in person. I at least got to...
Maybe that's why they won. It's because you finally stopped attending these Michigan athletic events.
Okay, I was 1-for-3 this week. I got the win on Wednesday. But I'm Alex Drain.
Not Alex Cook.
No.
Who you're often mistaken for.
Who mistakes me for Alex Cook?
I don't know. I was going for a bit.
Okay.
It didn't work. Okay. So you're 1-for-3.
I actually don't know what Alex Cook looks like, so.
Do you know what anyone at MGoBlog looks like?
Well, I was going through my camera roll this weekend.
Do you have, like, secret shots of all?
No, because every week I would have to take the photo that is the podcast, the MGo Radio, like, photo that gets posted on the site. So, like, I have, like, 30 photos of Brian and Seth sitting at that desk.
That's phenomenal. Why don't you just post them to Twitter and then tag them?
I found one with Bacon. I found one with Cassie Russell. There was all kinds of them out there.
Did you have any of Craig?
I'd have to go back and look again.
I wonder if he's real or if he's just a figment of all of our collective imagination. Anyway, people are probably not tuning in for our jibber jabber. They're tuning in for some reality checks on the hockey team, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, hockey's not a sport where you steamroll everybody, generally speaking. So
yeah,
there were going to be bumps in the road, and not that surprising that it comes against a well-disciplined and system team like Notre Dame.
The thing is, like, we watched them play Wisconsin, and they didn't really score for the first 5 periods. And, like, their play was very blah. Like, Wisconsin didn't play, like, their greatest game or their worst game or anything, but it just, Notre Dame looked like they were just there. And, I mean, their goaltending was subpar from what we're expecting to see from them. And neither of those things seem to happen this weekend, which is par for the course when Michigan plays Notre Dame.
Well, you know, Notre Dame got extra weeks to practice because they were off a week. And
yeah, whatever that is.
They came out ready to play, and, you know, they got Michigan to play the game they wanted them to play. And that's the big story of the weekend.
Well, and it helped that they got the first goal. Like, they right. kind of had a goal that, again, Michigan just kind of loses some puck battles on the boards, and Notre Dame is able to hold the zone, and it's just kind of like a nice shot from, I think it was like the corner of the house, north of the dot a little bit, and it just, I asked a couple people, they said it was tipped. Other people were like, no, it was just a good shot, it went inside the post. I'm not really sure. I don't really fault man on that shot per se.
It just, I mean, look, just top corner, boom.
Yeah.
It's there. The bigger story of that is that the goal was classic Notre Dame, right? So they dump the puck in, they send forecheckers up against the boards, Blankenberg and Power just get shoved around, knocked off the puck, and just overwhelmed. Their clearing attempt gets bottled up at the point, Notre Dame keeps it in, they get it across, good shot, and a goal. And that's how they were doing it. They were winning the puck battles in the corners and on the boards, and they were more physical, and you know, it went to their advantage in both ends of the ice.
Wow, you just did the whole podcast, pretty much. You're true to your masochistic self. You rewatched some of this game late last night, because I remember you were like texting me about it and like breaking things down. And the things that you were saying were like basically what you just described, and then you did that again and again and again.
Yeah.
And that was just kind of how the weekend went.
Yeah, had to review it for my column that is coming out this week, so it was necessary, but not the most enjoyable endeavor, but I did have Elton John's Greatest Hits on, so everything's a little bit better with that.
See, now our resident Elvis CD, not CD, wow, I'm a lot younger than I, okay, a record over there is disappointed in you. But so that is one thing that we talked about even going back to the end of last year when we knew who was coming to Michigan is like, look, this team is going to be skilled. We know they're going to be able to skate and they can pass and shoot and all those things, but you can't really like build size and strength as a 17-year and 18-year-old when you're playing against 19, 20, 21-year-olds. And Wisconsin didn't we saw that a little bit in the Wisconsin series. It seemed much more apparent in this series, and it just seemed to stand out that almost everyone on Michigan's team was pretty much pushed around by their counterpart.
Well, there's a sequence that I had highlighted. It was about a 25-second sequence in which Michigan holds the puck in, it was late second period of game one, and They have the puck in the Notre Dame zone for 25 seconds, which is a pretty long time. The entire play never leaves one small strip of the offensive zone from the blue line to the end line along those boards on the right side of the zone. It's there the whole time. And Michigan has two players that get knocked down to the ice during the series. Both Becker and Blankenberg end up on the ice. And, I mean, again, they're in the offensive zone. They're not passing. They're just standing there, you know, almost just chimney sweeping and, you know, just battling. And Notre Dame's just got them tied down. You know, it's like that, you know, that famous, like, tar thing that all those animals in, like, the Ice Age got stuck in, and then we found the fossils years later. Like, decades later, we'll find the fossils of this weekend at Yost, because Michigan was just stuck, I mean, in the muck all weekend long. Could not get any traction, could not move, and were just forced around the edges.
And I think the disappointing thing of that is, like, that's not new to this rivalry or series or whatever, but I think we were kind of hoping that wouldn't be the case this year because of the increased speed and skill and just sort of creative playmaking ability. And they did kind of break out of that a little bit later in game two. But at that point, it was, I don't want to say it was too late, but they were down at 3-0 at that point because of, I think, what we were talking about. When you're stuck in the corners and then you're getting beat up physically, you kind of speed everything up mentally, like, oh, I got to get it out. I got to move the puck. And Jack Summers and Cam York and a couple of the defensemen just had some pretty bad turnovers that led to the second and third goals, where I think you broke down Summers' kind of really bad shift for the second weekend in a row.
Yeah, so Summers has just a brutal, brutal shift where he... First, Notre Dame's not even really pressuring. They're outside the zone. He's got it behind the net. He makes a stretch pass vertically through the middle, trying to get it to forwards up the ice, and it gets picked off. Notre Dame then decides, okay, we're going to go on the attack. They dump it in and send the forecheckers up. Summers gets it again, has a second chance at it, and this one he just kind of whiffs, and it just spins off his stick. A forechecker is a few paces in front of him. The forechecker grabs the puck. Then the defensemen come up. Now Notre Dame's got a controlled offensive possession. And then he goes to the front of the net, and the screener is there, and they end up scoring on a shot from the point by Klerman that he is the one screening Strauss man. He's just standing there next to the Notre Dame guy. They're both screening, but he's the one that's the primary screener. And then it goes in. And, you know, one of the little things about defense is your ability to clear a net front. And, I mean, you know, besides his cannon of a shot, I mean, Rob Blake was able to ride his ability to clear the net front all the way to the Hall of Fame. Like, some of the best defensemen ever are able to do that. And there's a skill to be said, and that Summers isn't a big guy like Blake was, or Chris Pronger was another one who was great at that. But there's something to be said for guys that can clear the net front and can move out those screeners. And the problem really with Summers is he's not even really trying. I mean, the way I phrased it with you is that he might as well have been one of those cardboard cutouts of a dog. Or, I mean, he's just standing there. He's just standing there. He's not, you know, he's not trying to move the guy out of the way. He's literally just standing in front of his own net, and it's him that blocks the vision. So it was a really unfortunate sequence, and you can't grade a guy for one shift, but he had a previous one the last week. And the last week, it was the same thing, where he was the guy, the last line of defense, where he whiffs on... He was the guy that could have smacked the diagonal pass away, and he didn't do it. So it was not another great sign. And then obviously he was not in the lineup in game two. So Mel was watching the same things I was watching, I guess.
Well, that's encouraging that he didn't play in game two, because it's not just like beating your head against the wall, but it's hopefully addressing this issue that he's had a little bit. Right after that happened, you said something to me that was kind of interesting after what I'm about to describe, about Michigan kind of just freaking out and sort of playing emotionally, or feeling like they were trying to take one shot that was going to get them three goals, because Beniers gets the puck up the ice and is about to enter the zone and gets stripped. But basically, as he's entering the zone, and you can't turn the puck over, I get that, but Owen Power is also basically playing as a forward trying to enter the zone and create some sort of an attack. But the problem is when you do that as a defenseman and you turn it over, you're going the other way. The puck's going the other way. And in this case, Jacob Truscott was changing for Power's partner and was on the bench or just on the ice, leading to a Notre Dame breakaway.
So this goal, in my mind, the way they're playing here is what you do when you're down a goal with 30 seconds left in the game.
Just taking a chance.
I mean, you're sending everybody up. Here we go.
Yeah.
We're going to try and get the goal. But Michigan was doing this with 35 minutes left to go in the game. And I know I know that when you fall down 2 to Notre Dame, it feels like, you know, the opponent's got the knife to your throat. I mean, it feels like, oh, boy. And I sensed the same thing when that second goal happened, and it was like, you know, this is going to be a long journey back. It's going to be difficult. We're in a lot of trouble. But the response is then not to just kind of just go all out and
right.
throw, you know, the whole kitchen sink at it, and that's what they were trying to do. And, you know, Power's up on the play, and so I rewatched this play like 15 times trying to figure out, just, you know, replaying it over and over and over again to see, number one, how a Notre Dame guy was behind the play like that and where that last defenseman was coming from. And so it's Power and Blankenberg that are at the start of the play.
Mm-hmm.
They're going up the ice. Blankenberg vanishes from the screen. So the only explanation is he goes off for a line change.
Right.
And somehow a Notre Dame guy is just behind the play, which my only explanation is another line change. Because this is the second period. It's the period of the long change.
Right.
Which means the Notre Dame bench is closer to the Michigan goal than the Michigan bench is. So just from, if you have two players going off from a line change in the period of a long change, by virtue of distance, the Notre Dame guy will be behind the Michigan guy.
Correct.
And that's presumably what happens. Because this isn't fancy production like NBC in a, you know, an NHL playoff game where they have that angle that you get to see the whole ice and you
NBC
can watch the,
it.
Yeah, you can watch the whole all the players going off. Yeah. We get one angle for this, so
if that.
Yeah. Well, evaluating the forechecking, which is what I was trying to do yesterday, was just infuriating because anytime the Michigan player has it behind his net, which is when you want to see how Notre Dame's setting up their forecheck, you know, they zoom in to the point that we're looking at what, you know, ants are crawling on the jersey of the player.
What does Brian call that? Poravision, I think?
It's just like, stop! I want to see the other players,
yeah.
Not a close-up of this player. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that we can't get a better look at it all, but presumably it's a line change problem. Veneers get stripped, and Triscott's in a lot of trouble, and he realizes that. I mean, he's trying all he can, but it's way too late.
Yeah.
When the strip happens and Power's off the play, and it's just, you can't have all of that going on. There, something has to happen there. Either Power has to stay back because he knows Blankenberg is going off,
right?
Or when he goes up, Blankenberg can't go off yet because
right.
that
you can't
know,
do both.
Yeah, there's just a guy way behind the play. Beniers gets stripped. It's a great play, the defensive player for Notre Dame, and they set it up, and the guy scores, and then, you know, now you're at a point where you can throw the kitchen sink because you're down 3-0.
Yeah.
But you just tried it.
People were tweeting me saying one more and it's it for man. Not that they were sort of blaming man, but like maybe it's just time to rattle the cages of the rest of the team and say, hey, you know, you guys got to do something differently. Right after that, York, I also wrote down that York had a pretty bad defensive zone turnover and like Notre Dame almost made it 4. And,
yeah, that was a huge save.
Man made a huge save. Beniers then gets a breakaway right after that, and he gets run down, and you notice something interesting going back on the rewatch.
Yeah, I mean, watching that play again, because we never got to see a replay of it during the game, watching in my rewatch, it, you know, really was just a phenomenal play by Stastny on the back check there, because he's the one that makes the mistake. And he's the one that makes a pass that is intercepted that springs Beniers loose. And he recognizes he makes a mistake and plays a big part in fixing the problem, unlike another Michigan defender. But, you know, he really gets on his horse and just comes flying in. And he doesn't get to a point where he can get a stick on it. But I think that Beniers sees him, you know, in the peripheral vision.
Sensed him a little bit.
And he just kind of runs out of real estate. He's getting squeezed from behind, and he doesn't get to do a fancy move or really a deke, and he just kind of is reduced to shooting it, you know, sort of glove side, but it's not really a great shot, and he doesn't get a lot on it. So that's, you know, all the credit to the defenseman there.
Because if there's one guy on the team, maybe not one. If Panier's is probably in the top, what, three guys you'd want in a situation like that?
Probably.
Maybe Borlo, Johnson,
but, you know,
something like that. And the fact that he had to rush a shot meant that, you know, he's getting pressured from the backside, and, you know, that's kudos to the defenseman.
Yeah, and breakaways aren't all created equal, and that definitely was one where even Stastny was starting from a slightly better position than Truscott was, say, on the previous play.
No.
Because Beniers is breaking out sort of parallel to him, and Beniers gets the first step, and then he's coming from a diagonal, whereas Truscott was, you know, there was a big gap there, and so Beniers just didn't get the time to really make the play he wanted to make. So
Michigan does get some goals back. I believe late second, they get one back on a nice play from Truscott along the boards, hits sort of a cross ice / diagonal pass to Morgan, who was pretty much backdoor and had an easy tap in. Nothing crazy he had to do there. The goal, Bischel?
I was saying Bischel.
Bischel, but makes sense. He had no chance on that.
Yeah, that was, I'm the new sort of Jacob Truscott fan club leader, but that was a great play. Diagonal pass across the zone, sees Morgan on the back door, just a little tap in, and that was sort of the, okay, we're clawing back in it, right? We get that right before the intermission. If we can come out in the third period and get an early goal, then it's a game again.
Which, spoiler alert, is basically what happened. As I wrote down, one of the first things I wrote down about the third period was I thought it was a lot more open and that Michigan was able to get through the neutral zone. Now, Notre Dame was probably ceding slightly more territory, being up that many goals, and building, as you called it, their fortress. I tried to make a joke, I think, on Twitter about a cathedral, but they just basically protected their goalie, who was stopping everything anyway. But the second goal, I thought, was really kind of an intelligent play from Bordalo and a neat play from Mike Pasta, who I think has been impressive in the games that he's played so far this year. But he gets in down the right wing, kind of pivots like he's going to pass back, and then fakes it, drawing everyone's attention, turns on net, and just as he's turning on net, Thomas Bordalo comes flying through past him and jumps in front of Bischel, and Pasta shoots it right through his legs. And I would say, as good a play as that was by Mike Pasta, the time for a screen there from Bordalo was A+.
Leaping screens are one of my favorite things in sports, and that was really well done by Bordalo, and then the great shot from Pasajov, who has played really well this season, and you know that got Michigan back in it, and you really felt so. Before the period, we should preface this by saying that I told you that it was going to be 3-2 Notre Dame was going to be the final score.
Yep,
but I kind of envisioned it, Michigan scores with 2 minutes to go and just, our hopes get up, you know, late, and then nothing really happens. When they got that with 17 and a half minutes to go, I thought, oh boy,
they got shot.
Yeah.
Because they get another one, all of a sudden, then the air's let out of the balloon for Notre Dame, and you never know what's going to happen. And it actually almost happened, is they had probably their best rush of the entire weekend was, I believe it again was the Bordalo line, but they had a nice tic-tac-toe pass and hitting Granowitz as he gets behind the defenders. And this is all on the rush. And this is the thing that we talked about, or that we discussed, I think, that they would have to do in game two, is they didn't really get to it until the end of game one, or were able to do it, is getting speed through the neutral zone and beating Notre Dame's defenders back into place. And Granowitz gets behind them, not necessarily in sort of a breakaway, but he's in alone getting a pass, and Bischel just makes another game saver.
So on my rewatch, what I feel like would have been useful to know going into Saturday is that I don't think it was as much that Michigan made adjustments as much as it was Notre Dame for the first time was making mistakes. Mm-hmm. And that's what I noticed in that period where Michigan starts scoring is like, oh, for the first time tonight, Notre Dame turned the puck over. Like that. I mean, I sent you the message that was something like Notre Dame's breakouts have been virtuosic. Like,
yep,
they were just, every single time. It's a play between their legs in the corner to a defenseman there, to the forward, boom, and they're out.
It was tape to tape.
Tape to tape, everyone. it was really, really impressive. And so in that little period where Michigan scores, they start making sloppy passes, Michigan gets some turnovers, and that's when it starts to open up a little bit, and then Michigan, boom, boom, and then Notre Dame starts clamping down again.
Yeah, Michigan had a few other chances later on, but they pulled man with about, 2 minutes left. I tried to write down the timing of that. Never really had, that
The big problem is they couldn't win any faceoffs late. So they got routed in the faceoff dot in the first period. Then they did a good job to get it. It was almost even at one point in the third period in faceoff wins on Stat Broadcast. And then the last 5 minutes, I don't know if they won a single one. And all those big offensive zone draws they needed, they won very, very few of those.
So is that becoming an issue now, do you think?
I don't think so.
We've written this down and talked about it a couple times.
It just pops up at different points, and those things are hard to predict because we also don't write down a lot when they're winning all the faceoffs,
that's
right? So it's
true.
Just...
So they get close, look like they come back. Notre Dame's the last team in the world that you want to see to lead to and then have to rally against. But I was kind of hopeful going into Saturday just because of the way they finished the game and looked like there was some fire and some no quit in them.
Yeah, there was reason to be at least hopeful going into Saturday, even though it was just sort of this here we go again type thing. And again, Notre Dame played a really strong game on Friday, and they did everything that they want to do. And it's funny, you see all these tweets from people who don't watch a lot of college hockey, but
anyone?
Well, no. These are hockey people, but
okay.
Generally speaking, they're pro scouts who write for different blogs that I follow, and so they spend a ton of time watching junior leagues. But they want the player they specialize tend to in the CHL because that's where most of the draft prospects come from. They watch.
Sure.
A little Europe, a little college, but they don't know the intricacies of the Big Ten.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these people are now watching all of Michigan's games.
Because of everything, sure.
And they're just like, wow, Notre Dame reminds me of the 1990s. And I was like, oh, funny to hear that. We're used to it.
Why don't you check out our podcast?
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458 or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
Back to life, back to reality, back to life, back to reality.
Listening to one frustrating one goal loss to Notre Dame wasn't enough for you. We're going to do it again because Michigan did it again.
My whole life is frustrating one goal losses to Notre Dame.
Your whole life is also like an interesting Lions fandom that I was given preview to during our dinner tonight. This was kind of the same game, maybe sloppier from Michigan's end, not necessarily on defensive turnovers, because we talked a little bit about how that's a lot of what cost them, and you could kind of see the difference between Michigan's defense and Notre Dame's defense and who kind of screwed up in their own end more. Michigan didn't really have a lot of those bad gaffes in the second game. They just couldn't really create a whole lot in the offensive zone.
So the problem with Notre Dame really is that they run a style of the neutral zone trap. What style they run is a matter of dispute. I would have to watch a lot more to get a better idea. And it evolves depending on their situation, whether it's 1-4 or 2-3 or 1-2-2, etc. But the idea of the neutral zone trap is that at its core, it forces you to the outside. So You set up your players in the middle. It forces the opponent to go down the boards. And so what Notre Dame does is they stand there at the blue line. When you skate by, they clutch and grab a little bit. If the game isn't being tightly called, that goes, they get away with it, which is you know, it's coaching. They know how to do it to a level that doesn't normally get called.
Like DPI.
Yeah. And then it forces you to play dump and chase, more or less. You can also pass through it, which Michigan was able to do a little bit, but not a ton. And so the preferred method is to dump the puck in and try and win the race. But speed isn't going to do a ton because they obstruct you a little bit when you go by. And so it comes down to, can you win the battles in the corners? And Michigan wasn't winning a high percentage of those either night, and you're going to have trouble scoring when that's the case, when they're running that kind of system. I mean, how many times did Michigan have a guy skate with the puck into the zone? I mean, I was watching yesterday. I could have totaled it up if I wanted to, but, you know, the vast majority of their zone entries were dump-ins.
Oh, yeah.
And so every single time it turns into a battle in the corner, and Michigan wasn't winning a high percentage of those, so then you get caught in the tar again, and you're stuck. You're battling. Maybe you finally get possession. But then, by that point, Notre Dame's collapsed where four players are standing right around the net. Now you're just skating around the edges, and Notre Dame blocked a ton of shots.
So when you can't do that, you kind of have to take advantage of certain transition opportunities, which popped up for both of these teams in the second period. And, you know, it's you can get frustrated with sort of some of Michigan's chances because they did have a breakaway that they didn't score on, and they had a 2v1 with Bortolo and Post, I think, where Bortolo forced a shave. Yep, he's just now growing a beard. He forced a save, and then Pasta had a tip in that just went wide. And so you're like, oh, that could have been it. But Notre Dame also had a couple, and somehow they got a 3-on-1 on this, and it was really well executed, I thought. And Pearson made a really nice diving play to kind of force the guy below the goal line, but he somehow gets a puck back into the slot, and man just comes up with a huge save. So even then, you're like, oh, well, we had a chance. Well, so did Notre Dame. So both teams kind of seeded those odd man rush opportunities, and in the end, it kind of came out a wash, I think.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty even game into that third period, and you know, Michigan, they had a few chances. Notre Dame had a few chances. Michigan got a couple power plays, couldn't, you know, really do a ton with them.
Couldn't really even set it up a whole lot for a couple of them.
No, I mean, so the thing is with Notre Dame, too, in the 1990s, every NHL team ran a variety of the trap, but only certain teams were able to do it really well. And it's the same thing in college hockey, too. Like, MSU's tried to run a variety of the trap for several years now.
Michigan's done it in the last couple of
years. Oh, yeah, Michigan did it last year quite a bit. But the reason we remember the New Jersey Devils as the quintessential trap team, and some cool kids remember the Stars, too, but it's because you have the defenseman to do it. You have a great goalie. You have Hall of Fame defenseman, and you have good coaching. And, you know, the Devils had Jacques Lemaire, who set it up. You know, Burns later in their dynasty as well. And that's the thing with Notre Dame, is that they have really good coaching. Mm-hmm. They have good defenders. They know how to do it. And you just see the discipline, right? It's easy to do a trap where you're not disciplined and you're taking a lot of penalties, or your passes, your breakout passes aren't very crisp, or you don't know how to cut off passing angles and they pass right through it. But Notre Dame was doing it all really well. They were breaking it out well. They were blocking passing angles. They were blocking shots. And that's all the credit to Jeff Jackson.
And you said something to me about how it looks like Notre Dame could get in the zone against Michigan, and even when they would, they could still sort of pass through Michigan. And that's something else that's like, you know, that doesn't really have anything to do with a trap. Like, a trap is kind of slowing down the speed and the momentum of entering the zone. But it's another thing, like we talked about how well Notre Dame was sort of fundamentally sound and used their positions and sticks really well. But that wasn't really the case with Michigan. Not like they don't have guys that can't defend one-on-one, because we know that they kind of do, and they have probably multiple that are going to go to the NHL from this team. But playing sort of as a unit the way that Notre Dame's guys would, it's almost like those bubble hockey games where when you have like two or three or four guys that kind of crash in a zone and you just kept spinning their sticks around, and it was like created this sort of like blender, and you couldn't really go through it. If you wanted to get the puck to the other side, you had to shoot it around the back end or bring it out and re-enter it again, because there's like everything is in the way. And that's kind of not something that we saw from Michigan in their own end.
Yeah, I would definitely like to see Michigan try and cut off more passing lanes, just getting their stick out, you know, obstructing passes as it comes by, you know, just tipping, that kind of thing, that Notre Dame did a really good job of. And so that, you know, that's something to work on.
Yeah. So this game kind of drags through a couple periods again, and 0-0 entering the third, and you're kind of like, oh, geez, we've just done this so many times. I feel like, you know, it's like we just need a bounce or something. And it's right at the end of the second period. There's 1.7 seconds left on the clock, and Michigan wins, surprise, an offensive zone faceoff right back to Keaton Person, who fires a shot back against the grain of a sliding Bischel, and he just misses it.
Yeah,
goes
and that
to the
was
back of the net.
That was one of those mistakes that we talk about in game one. I mean, that's it was a decent shot, but that he just whiffs. I mean, Bischel just
missed it.
Yeah, just missed it, and so Michigan really got a boost there until
someone looked at a clock, and I looked at the guy who sits behind me, and I was like, time and physics would argue with this goal, because when the puck is dropped, if you're going to count 1.7 seconds, there is no way you can make a pass to the point and then rip a shot from 40 feet out.
It went from the center to a winger to the defenseman, and then he takes a shot. If the winger who has it first takes the shot, they're fine, but once I saw it go across, and then I saw the shot, I'm like, yeah, there's no way this is counting. Like, that was just in my head when I saw it, because I was like, there's no time to have gotten it over there. But I was surprised how close it actually was.
Yeah, you remember you said that.
I slowed down and tried to see. I mean, it probably was only like 0.2 or 0.3 tenths of a second short in the end. But
well, if that's not Notre Dame, Michigan, and frustrating, then I don't know what is. Especially then, because near the end of the game, Notre Dame finally cracks the ice and breaks the ice and has a shot from kind of near the point, maybe just off the boards, and it hits Mike Pasta's stick and just roofs up over man and under the bar. And, I mean, there's nothing you can do with that. Like, I'm not going to fault Pasta for trying to block the shot. That's what you do. That's why you have a stick in your hand. That's what Notre Dame has been doing. He just gets, I guess, the wrong angle or doesn't direct it enough, or I don't know, but it bounces off and goes over man, and you're like,
what you call puck luck.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what it is. And, you know, it just, like, that's kind of almost what it takes to beat man, it seems like. Like, either that or some really crazy turnover.
Yeah. It's just, that was the classic, just like, yep. you know, the whole game, as it ticks along, you get into the third period, you're like, I know where this is ending.
Yeah.
Like, this is, I've seen Michigan play Notre Dame. I've seen Notre Dame play. Like, this is what they want to do. It's going to be something stupid and, you know, late. And it's just like,
I was on the MGO podcast yesterday and said, it's kind of like Top Gun, where you have Iceman, and the reason he's Iceman is he flies ice cold until you make a mistake. And that's exactly kind of what Notre Dame has done to Michigan, like the last four times at Yost, at least. And, you know, then Michigan tries to rush, like we were talking about, and York has a subpar turnover in the neutral zone that leads directly to an empty net goal, which...
And that was within, like, seconds of them pulling man.
Right, where he's like almost at the bench, and
this is like their first attempt to get into the zone, and it.
And then, like, I was kind of like, well, yeah, that was going to happen. I wasn't really upset about it until like 30 seconds later, when Truscott unleashes a bomb from the blue line and scores to make it 2-1. I was like, well, of course. Like, why?
Well, and
your order of events here is just like.
But the thing is that goal doesn't happen if they don't fall down and then have the empty netter, because that's just how this works, you know. Like,
do you have like eyes that see into the fabric of the universe, that like it's like the Matrix code of just like how it's set up like that?
It's the Notre Dame hockey B-pone. So
I guess some takeaways that we should probably get into from the series. I mean, we talked a little bit about the physicality. We talked about how Michigan's not quite, quote-unquote, big enough. They struggle with physical opponents. They can improve some of their puck movement out of the zone and that sort of thing. One thing that I saw was, in addition to that Person shot that was a goal, I thought they had a couple nice face-off design plays where they had... Pasta came behind on a face-off win off of a wing and just ripped a shot that forced a save. And then they did that they sort of added a wrinkle to it the next time when he came around off of the board side to get the puck, and then instead of shooting it as he crosses the dot, he goes to the far side for a defenseman who shoots and forces another nice save. So those were kind of interesting things to see. And then, so it's like three times with off of faceoffs when they do win them in the zone that they were able to get a couple decent shots.
Yeah, and going back to the Truscott goal, I think there's a big case to be made for him to be on the power play just because that shot is really, really effective and a big-time weapon.
So do you want a shot there, or do you, if you're playing a 1-3-1, or do you want like a guy who can move the puck from side to side? Because like it seems like the guys you're trying to
well,
get...
Well, so they have two units, right? They have York at the top on one, and then they've got Blankenberg and Power on the other, and...
But Power isn't really playing as a defenseman there. He slides down and sort of plays on that Brisson-type wing. Because he also has a shot.
But I like Truscott's shot more than Power.
Okay. So you'd maybe put him on the side? Like on the wing?
Potentially. I just think it's a nice option to have. And we've seen it now enough that it is loud when it hits the, you know, the end boards if it goes wide. I mean, that is a shot with a lot of a zip on it. And I just think that that's something, that's a wrinkle you can add, right? It just put that into one unit, and that's a different feature you can show.
You also said to me that you think he might be currently Michigan's best defenseman.
Just in terms of his all-around performance so far, you can make that case. I mean, I haven't seen any mistakes he's made defensively that I remember.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
He's made some offensive plays. He scored a goal, and he made a great assist on Morgan's goal. I mean, he did more offensively than any other defenseman this weekend. And he didn't have any bad mistakes like we saw other defensemen, several, make. So, I don't know. He's passed the test so far.
No, I agree. So then the lines thing is, I think, the next thing we should probably address is that, you know, we were talking and it seems like Michigan has two really nice lines that we're excited when they get on the ice, and that's the Bordolo line, who's centering Pasta and Granowitz. And then, or sometimes Morgan, but they've sort of settled into Granowitz this weekend. And then obviously everybody's favorite line, I assume, which is the Johnson Beniers, and then either Becker or Morgan.
But let's also mention that the Bordolo line, it's not Thomas Bordolo, you know, dragging two carcasses on sleds behind him. I mean, Pastajov's played really well, and, you know, Granowitz has played well, and when Luke Morgan rotates onto that line, he's also had a nice season so far. So,
and I think with him is he's fast. So
yeah.
When you put him on a line, he can skate with those guys.
Yeah, so the Bordolo line in part is because the upperclassmen who have really stepped up are playing with him there too. So those two lines drive a lot of your offense. I think they need to be featured more in terms of time per game personally. But I think the bigger question then is, do you break, you move some pieces around to get the Beecher line going?
Yeah, and, you know, I just remember their first shift, and they created, like, three opportunities, and maybe that was Arizona State or whatever, but, like, it was like, oh, this line looks like it can jump, and then Lambert scores, I think, well, one was that power play pass, but the other one was Lambert scored on, I guess it was also another power play, so maybe all of my examples are not necessarily his line, but they looked like they had something going where it could be dangerous, but it hasn't really produced any points, and it almost looks sort of a little disjointed on the ice because they don't really have maybe a flow to how they move in the offensive zone.
So I think that part of it, there's a few pieces to it. So Jimmy Lambert's never going to drive a line at the collegiate level, and so he's a complimentary piece to begin with. Then you've got Brendan Brisson, who really hasn't shown much yet, and you're waiting to see that. I mean, we all hope to see what made him a first-round pick, but that hasn't... I mean, he has kind of disappeared in terms of his shifts.
But he's disappeared into the penalty box.
Yeah, so he takes one penalty per game, and most of them are in the offensive zone, which is alarming.
Yeah.
And then outside of that, all of my memories of him doing anything are on the power play.
Power play, yeah.
And so he's not doing a lot there that jumps out at you. And then I think there's just the central part that Beecher was a guy that I remember there was a lot of during the 2019 draft process lead up, there were many different opinions on Beecher. There were a lot of people that scouts that I read that absolutely hated Beecher as a prospect. Others loved him. You know, he's a prospect that doesn't have the high end talent of Bortolo necessarily. So you compare Bortolo to Beecher, right? They're picked very similar spots. They're both centers.
Late first round.
Or early second.
Okay.
Bortolo was picked like 39th. Beecher was 30th, I think. Yeah. So same range. But with Bortolo, you have a guy that isn't going to do a ton defensively, most likely. Not a great skater despite being small. He looks better as a skater because he's at the collegiate level now, but at least translating to the NHL, not as much. But he's a weapon when the puck's on his stick.
Right.
And he can make great passes, he can pick a defense apart, and he can make things happen when he's playing with the puck on his stick. So he's got one great thing and then some other negatives. With Beecher, it was more that, okay, he's better defensively than Bortolo, he's bigger than Bortolo, he, you know, is a true center, whereas Bortolo may not stick at the center position in the NHL, you may think. But Beecher all around, you read the scouting report, and it's more of, he does all these things well, but does he do anything great, right?
Yeah.
He's not slow. He's big. He can pass a little bit. He can win some face-offs.
Yeah, we've seen him have a shot last year.
He can shoot. He can play center. So he can do a lot of things. And in the NHL, you can see him being a really solid third-line center who can do a lot of different things. But Bortolo's a guy who, at the NHL level, might have top six upside because of that one singular trait. And so with Beecher, I just don't, at this current juncture in his career, he does not seem to be a high-end creator, a guy who's going to pick a defense apart and really make things happen. And you know, he's going to be defensively responsible, and he is going to show up in some big moments, but he's not Beniers. He's not Bortolo,
like,
and that's clear.
It seems like when he enters the zone, he enters it with some sort of power, and he looks like he's going to try to drive the net. Like, and then sometimes he ends up taking a shot from like a steep angle, or he goes around back depending on, you know, how the defenseman plays it. But it's not really like when you see Beniers or Johnson enter the zone like that, they've done a variety of things with the puck. Like sometimes they spin around so that they're facing back towards the middle of the ice because they're looking to pass. They know where someone is. You know, it's Beecher's is kind of sometimes seems like he has his mind made up as to what he's going to do.
So I think one thing you could do is play. You could try to put Pastajov with Beecher, maybe someone that's playing well on a different line, or you could try and move Brendan Brisson to play with Luke Morgan, maybe someone who's fast that could at least get him some chances through that. Those are some possible explanations. I mean, I feel like Bortolo is going to be effective no matter who you put him with. He's better with guys that are playing well. I mean, you could put Brisson with him.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a possibility.
Because he needs a shooter.
Yeah. And Beniers, I think, is going to drive that line regardless. I mean, we're still waiting to see what Kent Johnson can do. I'm not really inclined to put Kent Johnson with Beecher, honestly, because Johnson's not like a high-end speed guy, right? He's a guy that really makes intelligent and cerebral passes. But I'm not sure if that's the best mix. I mean, you'd have to really tinker with them and see what line combinations. The only thing I'm set with is keeping Moyle and Raby and, you know, Fanwy together. That is just a unit that's
healthy,
untouched from the rest of the team.
And they do what they do well. It's not going to be high-end producing, but they do fight in the corners. They do create some of those dirty chances. And, you know, having them as like third or fourth line is kind of what a skilled team needs, because there are going to be games when they're going to be effective. And they were effective to some extent this weekend. They did create some of those chances. They weren't high-end because Notre Dame kind of was just didn't get beat by anybody. But they can play a style that can work sometimes against a defense like that.
I think really there's just the fact is that the Beniers line is your first line, the Bortolo line is your second line, the Beecher line is your third line, and the Vanwy line is your fourth line. And I don't have the minutes allocation up on the top of my head right now, but you know, again, line charts are line charts, but that's really a formality.
Yeah. So I think we can be done with Notre Dame finally, at least until we have to go to South Bend, presumably.
Michigan does a lot better at South Bend than they do at Yost against Notre Dame. So
yeah, which is very different when it comes to football. But anyway, you knew we were going to have to bring that up at some point. So Michigan next has Penn State on, of course, a Wednesday, Thursday, because that's when college hockey's played.
Why not?
Yeah, I mean, we'll get one day off from this, and then we're going to be covering more games. And anyway, so enough about our troubles. So if someone in the Big Ten has troubles, it might be Penn State.
I, for one, am very thankful. This is a Thanksgiving theme segment, but I'm thankful for for Guy Kiedowski for having Penn State play the way they do. It's just a joy to watch, especially. It's the oasis in the desert after having just watched Notre Dame. Like, even if Michigan doesn't win, I just want to see 7-5 or some something, you know, just reminding us of the way it's really supposed to be.
And so they played Wisconsin, I guess. I don't even know what day it is anymore or when these games are even played. The last time I saw these teams play hockey.
We don't leave this little studio.
We
days just go by and we don't know.
And so they play Wisconsin, and I think the first night they have like 52 shots, and Wisconsin has like 20, but Wisconsin gets 6 goals off of their 20 shots, and Penn State gets like 3 off of their like 50 plus. And to some extent, that reminded me of Michigan hockey a few years ago, where they were starting to be able to control the puck a little bit more, but never got a grade A opportunity. And when they got a grade A opportunity, they had no one who could actually score from those opportunities. But yet their defense was just so sieve-like that they just gave up these really, really juicy chances and ended up losing games where the goalie has no chance.
Yeah, Penn State, so we've talked about this before. They play a really just open system, high scoring, but it's not true like 80s hockey where you're just trading odd man rushes and breakaways necessarily. They do get some of those, part of the system that they do is they just throw everything at the net.
Cross the blue line, shoot.
That's how you get 40 to 50 shots a game and not be the most dominant team anyone's ever seen.
Yeah.
Is that what other teams would pass or try and set plays up? They just throw shot after shot after shot. Everything's a shot.
Yeah,
and
Michigan now might look for a better chance, trying to get it in the house or the slot. Penn State enters the zone, can see the goalie, they're firing away.
Yeah, and they have, in the past, lots of offensive firepower. Not as much right now because they lost everyone from last year's team, so they are really resetting their roster. And they've got some talented players still, and Gadowski's been a really good coach for them, and he's gotten them into the tournament. He had them as the Big Ten champions in the regular season last year, and so you have to think he'll figure it out. It's just you lose a lot of players, and you have just problems with younger faces, and that's part of it. The other problem is that their system really, really relies on having a goalie who can save a high percentage of the chances you give up. Because they're going to give up a ton of grade A chances. And Peyton Jones was a good goalie in terms of just keeping that percentage high, that he was going to steal enough of those grade A chances for them to win. And their new goalies, I think they've got two of them. Oscar Audio was the one that was playing against Wisconsin. He was not saving a high percentage of those. And if you give up, you know, 6 goals a game, that's a problem.
Yeah, especially when there's very few shots. That just kind of tells you. It's just indicative.
And I don't think he's a bad goalie necessarily. Maybe. No. I don't know. I mean, it's just so many of these chances. You know, it's a guy all alone right in front of the crease, and or just breakaways, or maybe it's just the defense being sliced up, a passing play, a guy cuts to the net, boom, there's the putt. You know, and Peyton Jones was good at keeping enough of those out for them to play their style. And right now, their current goalies are not that.
It's basically like telling a cornerback, we're going to blitz 7, and so you're either going to make the play or you won't.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what they do to him. And, you know, a lot of times in the past, they were able to get a bunch of goals that they could average that out. But this year has not seemed to be like that. So.
And this is a style of game Michigan would love to play.
And it might be one that they need to play after this past weekend.
Yeah, refresh them a little bit.
There were also a few other series that took place throughout the last 7 or 8 days, based on whatever day it is. I think you brought up, texted me last night, and were like, the Ice Devils just swept the Badgers. And I was like, what?
Yeah, so Arizona State finally got their first wins of the...
Plural.
Yeah, they got two of them.
In Madison.
Yeah, and Wisconsin at that point was 4-2. Now they're 4-4, so they have sweeps of Penn State and Notre Dame and sweeps at the hands of Michigan and Arizona State. So a little odd in that combination, but I didn't get to see enough of those games. They were both very high-scoring games, though, so that's interesting. But all more fuel to the Arizona State isn't actually bad bandwagon.
Maybe Johnny Walker played again.
Yeah, we'd have to check the box score, but
assuming he probably did it
for that's more research than we get paid to do. So
box scores are hard.
And then, it's final season for me, so.
That's right. I keep forgetting you're still in school. We also had one other series. It was, you know, okay, so I do remember this now because the guy who sits behind me at Yoast had this game on his little tablet, and it was Michigan State, Ohio State, and I also bring my tablet to Yoast because I figure, all right, there's going to be some game that in some sport I'm going to want to at least keep an eye on while I'm there, and I didn't really have an interest in opening up my tablet to watch that game. I was just like, I'll find out who wins. And
they got a split.
So nobody.
MSU wins one in overtime, and then Ohio State wins one in regulation. So
4-2?
Yeah. I mean, Ohio State did not look very good against Minnesota in my viewings. The fact that they were roughly even with MSU is about expected. I think that they're a little farther down the Big Ten. I mean, I think Minnesota, Wisconsin are probably towards the top still. Notre Dame is Notre Dame. We have to watch more of them. It could be very feasible to me that Notre Dame is a mediocre team and that just did that because they're so well coached all the time. And any, you know, upsets in the NHL happen because sometimes teams fall into the trap and
well, they do
that's the way it goes.
Like you said, they do that to
everybody. I mean, Notre Dame last year had a negative goal differential on this season for the Big Ten play. We're firmly mediocre. And they swept Michigan at Yost in the same fashion. So, like, it's totally conceivable. It's feasible that Notre Dame is very good. It's feasible that they're actually just okay. And that can happen because of the system they play. So,
right. Yeah. I'm
and because they have the fundamentals drilled down.
I think that we think Minnesota's probably going to be pretty good. Now, they play two of the teams we think probably aren't as good because they swept Penn State and they swept Ohio State. And so those are games that we think, you know, you probably have to win if you're Minnesota, especially since they were all at home, and Michigan gets them next week. But that series took an interesting turn a few days ago.
Today, as a matter of fact.
Oh, was it today?
Yeah.
I thought there was a tweet out yesterday. But
no, it was, anyway, I guess it was yesterday, but then we got clarification today.
I see.
Michigan and Minnesota are both going to have to play that series with a hand tied behind their back because Michigan will be losing a bunch of forwards, and Minnesota will be losing a bunch of defensemen. So Michigan is losing. We should preface this by saying that Team USA is starting their World Juniors camp like Canada, which was much of the Owen Power thing from earlier. Similar story. Team USA had told Mel and other coaches that the camp would be starting like December 13th or something. So the Big Ten set the schedule deliberately as well. They had said during the Wisconsin series, those Mullet Man and,
and Jim Brandstetter,
they had said that the Big Ten set the schedule deliberately so that Michigan wouldn't have to play any games beyond that date. Right. Well, Hockey USA changed the date and moved it up because of an outbreak of COVID that is currently at the Canada camp. So Owen Power's thankful he's not there.
Yeah.
And where they're all quarantined now and blah, blah, blah. So Team USA now wants more time in case they get an outbreak. So they moved the date up. And unlike Canada, the U.S. plays a lot of undrafted players, which includes Paniers in this situation in particular.
He's going to be young.
Yeah, and then also Bortolo, who was previously drafted, Beecher, who was previously drafted, and York, who was previously drafted. Mm-hmm. They all have to go, as well as, for Minnesota, Brock Faber, Jackson Lacombe, and Ryan Johnson, who are all second or first, I think they're all actually early second-round picks, but they're all good players, and those are three of Minnesota's probably top four best defensemen. So they're really gutted at the defenseman position, Michigan more so at forward, losing Bortolo, Beecher, I think Brisson was in that too, and then Beniers, but also York as well. So both teams are really losing some big pieces. And Minnesota, not just as the three of their top four defensemen, but the defensemen are the strength of their team. And they play from the back forward. I love the way they play. Their forechecking system lets the defensemen sit back, make the passes, then they move up on the play and they attack. And so both teams, I mean, we'll preview that series next week, but both teams are going to be down a little bit.
And that kind of sucks, is because those are the two teams that you think are probably, in the end, probably going to be the two best teams in this conference. And for two of the four games that you're going to see between them, at least, you know, in the regular season, you're going to be missing, what, 8-9 guys?
Yeah, and Wisconsin will lose Caulfield as well. We don't see them, but that will be a consideration for them, too. I don't remember if Sam Stang was in that as well, but they also have, I think, a small COVID outbreak going on in Madison as well, so a lot of turmoil across the Big Ten. Pays to be MSU and have no talent. Thank you for listening to Michigan HockeyCast 3.4. Come back next week where we may know the day of the week. Also, we may not, but you'll enjoy listening.